Ukraine calling.
We don't have the logistics to go deeper into Russia, and maybe that's not the aim.
Technically, according to Putin's version of saying, it is Ukraine that is occupying Russia and not Russia that is occupying Ukraine. How long will Russians not care about the fact that 1,000 of their young men are being killed or wounded on a daily basis? Your chances of having a shower every 4 weeks is virtually non-existent, but your chances of survival are minimal as well. And here I am sitting in New York in my easy chair, telling young Ukrainians that they should put their lives on the line. It's a very special military operation.
Good day, everybody. This is Brian Bonner, host of Hromadsky Radio's Ukraine Calling program. We are in August, and big things tend to happen in August, especially in Russia and also in Ukraine. So with me today, I couldn't think of a finer person to talk about what is happening in Russia's war on Ukraine, especially with the Ukrainian incursion into Russian territory that is now a week old. Alex Moyler, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Brian. It's a pleasure.
Alex is he's a PhD, so he's Dr. Moidel. He's professor of political science at Rutgers University in Newark. I have to take one of your classes sometime because they must be fascinating. You are author of at least 10 books. They're all on my reading list, as are many books I hope to get to. At least four are fiction. But Alex has really distinguished himself. Well, he was always prolific, but he seems to have really hit his stride or still peaking as a writer during the full-scale invasion. His work is almost daily, almost everywhere, in The Hill and other publications. So before we jump into everything, Alex, I mean, you seem really, really motivated to cover and comment on this war. Personal reasons, or you just, as a writer, you have so much more material to work with?
Well, the latter is true to some degree, of course, but it's frankly a personal issue. I take the war very personally. I've devoted something like 50, 55 years of my life in various forms to the Ukrainian cause, however defined. When Ukraine finally became independent and then seemed to be on the way to becoming, you know, more or less democratic, more or less prosperous. In any case, it was evolving the right way, more or less. That seemed like a culmination of my mission in life, my political mission in life. I have many others, obviously, as well. So the war, to me, is an outrage, obviously. It's stupid, it's unnecessary, it's criminal, all those things apply. But it's also an outrage to me personally. And I can't forgive Putin. I don't think Ukrainians can forgive Putin, rightly so. But even in my New York apartment, I can't forgive Putin for having done what he did to Ukraine and for having done what he did to me. So I've taken this very, very personally. And I'm on a war path. Part of my mission in life over the last 2 years is to persuade the world that Putin is a criminal, a fascist, an imperialist, the embodiment of evil, quite frankly.
I agree. I find your commentaries motivating. I think a lot of people do, because we're still not quite there yet in terms of universal acceptance of the view of Putin, which I agree with, because I'm an American, but I live in Ukraine as a permanent resident, and he has damaged the nation in ways that, you know, is going to take a long time to recover from, assuming we get out of this war in good shape. You know, one of the things Alex has been, for those who haven't read Alex, and I've read dozens or hundreds of his columns going back, and before we talked, I went back to the Kyiv Post, which I led for 14 years from 2008 to 2021. And we started publishing and republishing Alex's column since 2010. Very prescient. I came one today. Viktor Yanukovych had just taken power in 2010. And sure enough, there's Alex's column. If if Yanukovych doesn't change course, he will inspire a revolution. And that's just one example, although Yanukovych was prone to do that for Ukraine. But well worth watching and books well worth reading. Alex, jumping into the news, it's now a week since this surprise incursion. Do we know yet whether it's going to be change the course of the war, or it's just going to be a sugar high morale boost, or is it too soon to tell?
Well, it's obviously too soon to tell. On the other hand, you know, I disagree with people who say, well, it's just a small incursion. Sooner or later, Ukraine will have to withdraw simply because they won't be able to sustain the losses that might be incurred in keeping control over the territories. And hence, it's likely to be no more than a blip. I disagree with that. Even if you assume that Ukraine, let's say, expands for a few more hundred square kilometers and then eventually starts withdrawing, and that could be in a few weeks, it could be in a few months, the mere fact of this, I call it a special military operation.
Yeah.
It's not just an incursion. It's a very special military operation. The mere fact that this has taken place is of enormous importance. It shows, amongst other things, that Ukraine remains in the game. As you know, the prevalent view over the last few months, at least in the West and to some degree in Ukraine and certainly in Russia, is that Ukraine won't be able to win back the territories it's lost, that the situation on the battleground is a stalemate. And since it's a stalemate and since the war is never ending, it's a permanent stalemate. I mean, you've heard all this. The only thing that's left to do is to declare a ceasefire, go to the negotiating table, give Putin what he wants, or give Putin some of what he wants, and things like that. Well, this shows that the Ukrainians are far from dead. I mean, as the national hymn said, Ukraine is not yet dead. Well, it's anything but that. It's clearly shown that it has the capacity to drive forward, seize territory, and even if it withdraws, it will have made that point. It's also important, the incursion is also important, because it has radically changed the discourse here in the United States, as well as in Europe. I'm less familiar with the Europeans. Again, the prevalent view until last week was that this was a dead end, that this was a stalemate, and that was pretty much it. Now, suddenly, all the commentators, including the military commentators who never foresaw this or who predicted that it would be over within a day or two, are now talking about the possibility of this being a game changer, this having some kind of significant impact on the war. That may or may not happen. I mean, I'm hoping that it does, but it may or may not. It doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is that the discourse has changed. And in the United States in particular, this change couldn't have come at a more appropriate time, because we're in the throes of this electoral campaign. Both sides are making references to the war in Ukraine. And the fact that Ukraine has shown what it can do obviously bolsters the view of people like Harris and Waltz, that supporting Ukraine isn't just a waste of American resources. And it forces people like Trump and Vance to be perhaps a little more proactive in their attitude towards Ukraine. They can't just assume that this is going to be a never-ending war. So Ukraine has achieved an enormous amount, regardless of what the ultimate conclusion to this incursion will happen to be.
There are limits, though, and even soldiers have been quoted as saying, we don't have the logistics to go deeper into Russia, and maybe that's not the aim. But, you know, many things seem clear. One is that this did show what Ukraine is capable of doing if it got the weapons it needed instead of the halting Western support that it's had.
Well, it's also shown, you know, it's shown what Ukraine could do were it, if it has the support that it needs. But it's also shown the depth of Russian incompetence. That was the prevailing view of the Russian army for about a year after the invasion. You know, how could they possibly have gotten so much wrong so quickly, so extensively? Then the Russians seemed to have bounced back. They were counterattacking. They were resisting. They started this incremental movement in the Donbas area. And again, the view of the Russians, both within Russia, but also outside, was they seem to have gotten their act together, and who knows what this will then portend for the Ukrainians, for the war, and so on. Well, this particular incursion, the rapidity with which the Ukrainians have been able to capture these territories, the fact that thousands of Russians fled, they just threw their stuff on the ground and ran, which is similar to what happened in Kharkiv a couple of years ago. And it seems to be the case that at least several hundred and possibly close to 1,000 or two have surrendered.
Yeah.
And the people and these guys, I mean, they are unfed. As I read, several of them haven't had a shower in weeks. I mean, all of this is testimony to the fact that the army is in very bad shape. And it's also testimony to the fact that the FSB, the military intelligence, all these people who are getting paid big bucks to foresee what Ukrainian plans are incapable of foreseeing what Ukrainian plans are. This is wonderful news for Ukraine, because it really just goes to show that we're talking about a colossus with clay feet.
Indeed. I mean, in retrospect, it looks like they paid the Ukrainian military leadership paid very close attention to Prigozhin's aborted march on Moscow, as well as I'm wondering if the Free Russia insurgents didn't also help with intelligence, or, you know, Ukraine had good intelligence on the ground. All that is very encouraging. I am, you know, I know you're optimistic, and I guess some people call me pessimistic. I would say realistic, but we've been there before. You know, I was encouraged when Kyiv got, when Ukraine took back Kyiv, Kharkiv, all that, and Russia, and, you know, we want Putin to die, and we hope Russia collapses and goes home. That just seems like a hope. Because they do seem to be a lumbering giant that slowly, slowly, slowly comes back. And today, lo and behold, just before our conversation, Anastasia Edel published in the New York Times saying that basically op-ed saying Russia, Putin is on the cusp of victory, and that there's basically the West is not going to stay with Ukraine. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You believe that this could change that seat, as you said, it could be the narrative, but do you believe this is enough to change the narrative?
Well, it obviously depends on what happens in the next few weeks. I mean, if Russia rallies its forces and simply throws out the Ukrainians, throws them out of Kursk Oblast in some very humiliating fashion, then people will once again argue, aha, we told you so. Yeah. Ukrainians may be capable of a brief incursion, but ultimately, you know, they can't possibly compete with the Russian forces. If alternatively, the Ukrainians manage to hold on to a good portion of this territory for a significant period of time. Now, again, what is significant? Who knows? Well, at least until the U.S. elections, let's put it that way. Then the argument for Ukraine's being a pygmy with clay feet will be difficult to make. Likewise, if the Ukrainians withdraw a bit, it will still but remain you know, in control of even a sliver of Russian territory. That'll still be significant. It'll also be significant for the following reasons. Everybody's been saying, and Putin especially, well, why don't we just freeze things as they are?
Right.
And proceed on that basis. Well, the Ukrainians, even if they control just a sliver of Russian territory, can now say, sure, let's do it. And Putin is in no position. He simply cannot afford to surrender Russian territory to Ukraine. even if it's just 1 square kilometer, that would be impossible for him and his legitimacy. So effectively, as long as Ukraine controls some Russian territory, that particular argument cannot be made by the Russians. It can be made by anybody else, but it will simply have no effect, of course, because the Russians will never, ever agree to that, to giving up sacred Russian territory. Won't work. Can't possibly happen.
Especially when they consider Ukraine part of their territory.
And then there's that.
You have talked there's no point in any negotiation with Putin whatsoever. This has to be a Ukrainian clear victory. Do you still believe that there's no hope for any kind of negotiation that would be acceptable to Ukraine?
Well, yeah. I mean, that doesn't mean Ukraine shouldn't be calling for constantly be calling for negotiations. And of course, it's doing that by having organized that peace summit. Now they're organizing the second version of the peace summit. And Zelensky and others have been saying and should continue saying that they're always ready to sit down at the table and negotiate everything. On condition, of course, that all of the territories, some of the territories, most of the territories be returned to Ukraine. So Ukraine should certainly continue making that point. I don't see how Putin can agree to anything short of what he wants, which is to say, at the very most, he wants the complete destruction of the Ukrainian state and nation. Minimally, he wants to retain Crimea and the entirety of 4 oblasts, Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. And as you know, he doesn't even control all 4 of them. So technically, by virtue of the Russians having annexed these territories and made them part of the Russian Federation, technically, according to Putin's version of things, it is Ukraine that is occupying Russia and not Russia that is occupying Ukraine. He can't agree to give up those territories. He would have, I mean, if only because he'd have to change the constitution and enable Russia to de-annex territories, because as you know, there is no such provision in the Russian constitution. Now, again, that sounds like a formality, but even he has to concern himself to some degree with questions of legitimacy and so on. So I just don't see his making that move. And then last but not least, keep in mind that essentially he has identified himself 100% with the outcome of the war. He's done that. Russians have done that. Remember when Surkov declared about 10 years ago, "Без России, без Путина России нет." Well, again, he was essentially expressing the view that Russia is Putin. Putin is Russia by extension. Putin is identical, isomorphically identical with the war. And his survival now depends on the outcome of the war. For him to agree to losing parts of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Luhansk, and Donetsk, because essentially he'd have to, if they simply draw the line at as it is today, he'd be officially saying that even though these territories are annexed, I'm giving them back to Ukraine. Well, he can't say that. He cannot say that. Someone else can. If he's ever overthrown, another Russian could come in and say, look, this is Putin's business. It's stupid. It's a mistake. We're going to go back to square one. We'll change the constitution, whatever. But he can't say that.
Well, that argues for an endless war. And the other thing is, as you pointed out, who would enforce a peace agreement with Vladimir Putin, who hasn't lived up to any of them? I don't see a force in the world that can do that, do you?
Well, that's the other point. You know, even assuming he were to sit down and agree to all sorts of wonderful things, he could agree to Ukraine's permanent security, and he could even claim that Russia will never attack. No one would believe that, and no one should believe that. And then if and when he breaks that particular promise, what then? So that's why, you know, all these discussions about Putin going to the negotiating table, they're pie in the sky. And the people who promote these sorts of views, at least in the West, are people who are generally international relations experts who have no knowledge of Russia or Ukraine.
Exactly.
So they're simply projecting their image of some sort of rational leader onto their theoretical schemes. Whereas if there's anything we can say about Putin is that he is, I mean, if he's rational, it's a rationality that is very foreign to the way that most Americans and Europeans would think. Now, whether that's rational in his peculiar sense or is that whether that's irrational, it doesn't really matter. It's the rationality of a person living on a different planet.
You wrote for many years that Ukraine should just give up the Donbas. Do you still feel that way? Write it off.
Again, the argument was a little more nuanced. The argument I was making was that Ukraine is better off without that particular territory. In other words, and this is an argument that I started making in 2014, namely, look, it's occupied. That means that you don't have to provide it with economic subventions, and they were enormous. You don't have to worry about a resurgence of the Communist Party. You don't have to worry about a resurgence of the region, Party of Regions. This particular electorate will not be taking part in general elections. In other words, one of the main obstacles, arguably the main obstacle to Ukraine's reform efforts and its move westwards, is no longer an issue. It's out there. So accept it for what it is, namely it's occupied temporarily or not, who cares? But the point is it's occupied. And in the meantime, that gives you the opportunity, namely you Ukrainians who are now in pro-Western, pro-reform Ukraine, it gives you the opportunity to roll up your sleeves and introduce a variety of reforms, make Ukraine more democratic, more prosperous, more Ukrainian, more Western, and so on and so forth, which, by the way, is essentially what happened under Poroshenko. You know, I don't want to idealize them, but that's basically what Ukraine was doing. And none of that, I would argue, none of that would have happened had it not been for the fact that this particular territory, including Crimea, of course, had been occupied by the Russians, because these were always those territories, those populations, rather, that were most retrograde, most anti-Western, most anti-Ukrainian, most pro-Soviet, most pro-Russian. Suddenly, they're gone. Now, whether they're gone permanently or not, who the hell knows? But take advantage of the situation, and rather than bemoaning the fact that they are now on the other side of the battle front, take advantage of this and start reforming and changing your country in the appropriate way. So would I make the same argument today? Well, to some degree, you know, you don't have to worry about the populations anymore because, of course, we don't really know who these people, I mean, who's left in the Donbass, and we don't know what their political views are. So for all we know, they may all now be Bandera supporters as opposed to Lenin supporters. But that said, you know, don't hurry with a reannexation. Take advantage of this lull and introduce the appropriate changes. Get Ukraine as close as possible to the EU and NATO in the time that you have. And then be in the position, if and when these territories are fully or partially reincorporated, to move westwards, to move in a reform direction anyway, regardless of whether or not these territories or these populations represent a ballast, whether they represent some kind of hindrance.
Given what you said, and given Putin's, and not just Putin's imperial ideology, of which you've written books, and given the fact that it seems, at least to me, that NATO membership would be the only guarantee, we're looking at an endless war. That means, or a war that's not going to end soon. This means that Ukraine, as Zelensky said at the beginning of the war, has to become a big Israel. Is Ukraine capable of that? Because I'm sure you've noticed the problems they've been having mobilizing enough army and supplying enough resources on their own to get to be less dependent on the West. Can Ukrainian society, as you understand it, are they up to that task of a very protracted war?
Before I answer that, and remind me that you asked me that just in case I forget,
right.
Let me address the first part, namely that this is going to be an endless war, because that particular view is premised on Russia's ability to conduct such a war. And I am not at all certain that it is capable of conducting an endless war. Personally, I believe, I really do believe, not just because I'm an optimist, but I really do believe that time is on Ukraine's side. Or to put it differently, time is definitely not on Putin's side. So for starters, I mean, we cannot make the assumption that Putin will remain in power indefinitely. He's already been in power for 25 years. He's 72 or thereabouts. Some people say he's about 74, 75. Or a Russian male, this is an astounding longevity. So if Mother Nature doesn't take care of him, it's not inconceivable, or rather, let me put it this way, it is extremely likely that sooner or later there will be something resembling a putsch, a coup, an effort to push him to the side. Again, I firmly believe that. I'm not the only one, as you know. I mean, there are lots of Russians and Ukrainians who are of this view as well. But I do think that's very, very likely, if only because whatever one can say about the indifference to suffering or the indifference to democracy on the part of Russian population, the fact is neither most Russians nor most Russian elites are that stupid, are so stupid as not to see that he's driving the country into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that someone will therefore arise and challenge his power? Well, actually, yes. And that happened in mid-2023 with the Prigozhin coup attempt. And more importantly than the Prigozhin attempt, or whatever it is, it's often referred to as a mutiny. I think it was more than that. More important than the fact that he launched this mutiny is the fact that the FSB, the GRU, and the military sat on the sidelines and simply watched.
I understand what that means. I'm really hoping and rooting that you are totally right again. Until that day, though, we see a Russian economy that's on war footing. We see sanctions that are not particularly strong in cutting oil and gas or other revenue that Russia has. And we see Ukraine under big stress in trying to mount that. And that's just aside from the political situation, which I hope we end the conversation with. But given all that situation, it seems to me that since this attitude is not just Putin's, it does seem to go deep into Russian society that Ukraine is not a real country. Can Ukrainian society fight this thing for many more years to come as well, or as long as needed?
Well, you know, none of us knows the answer to that question, obviously. So the best we can say is, well, these are the reasons why one may assume that the answer is yes, or so on. If the West continues to supply Ukraine with assistance, even at the level that it's been supplying it heretofore, and it's not insignificant. I mean, yes, the F-16s should have arrived a year ago. They finally came a few weeks ago. Yes, there should have been more HIMARS a year ago. And you know, yes, all of that is absolutely true. So, you know, this dribs and drabs approach is definitely counterproductive. That said, it's better than the alternative, which is nothing. The alternative isn't necessarily, you know, a plethora a sudden plethora of ammunition and weapons. It's the alternative is the Vance point of view, namely, you know, who cares about Ukraine? I certainly don't. So let's just stop providing any assistance whatsoever. So in any case, the point is, if the West continues to support Ukraine, and this is the big if, and if Putin remains Putin, that's not a big if. That is, and by that I mean fascist imperialist committed to a genocidal war whose ultimate goal is the destruction of the Ukrainian nation and state. That I think we can take for granted. If those two conditions are in place, then Ukrainians simply have no choice but to continue resisting.
And that means, would you agree that means throwing every able-bodied man 18, 20 years above into the fight?
Well, not necessarily. You know, when you look at what's happened on the battlefield over the last few months, again, the statistics on this are clear. The Russians, on average, are losing about 1,100 soldiers on a daily basis. I mean, the Ukrainian number, whether it's one-third, one-fifth, one-eighth of that, is certainly significantly lower.
And Russia lose, and they don't care about human life, as we found out.
Well, this is the point, right? How long will Russians not care about the fact that 1,000 of their young men are being killed or wounded on a daily basis? We know that it's having some impact. As you know, back in 2022, the Russians were offering 200,000 rubles to volunteers. Now that's actually gone up to about 2 million rubles. And this is, so it's a significant increase in the course of 2 years. And that's,
amazing. Translated to dollars, that's like, I think I'd read that $60,000 a year if you're from Moscow, which is quite a salary.
Which is quite impressive, but it's also indicative. But it's all, again, you know, just using supply and demand. Obviously, they're raising the price because there are fewer people volunteering,
right?
Understandably so. I mean, you know, word certainly must have gotten out to some Russians, if not to all of them, that if you're sent to the battlefront in Donetsk, your chances of survival are minimal. Your chances of having a shower every 4 weeks is virtually non-existent, but your chances of survival are minimal as well. So, you know, as much as one needs to focus on the stresses to which the Ukrainian population is being subjected, one needs to keep in mind that the stresses to which the Russian population and the Russian elites are being subjected are as great, if not significantly greater.
The thing is, they have more to lose. But I'm just getting your opinion, because this is a very controversial issue. Would you lower the draft age to 20, the conscription age? I'm having a hard time with that word.
Yeah.
Should we not have more people in the fight?
Well, the answer is, unfortunately, yes. Again, I feel uncomfortable responding to this because I'm obviously not of draft age. And here I am sitting in New York in my easy chair, telling young Ukrainians that they should put their lives on the line. So I really don't have a moral right to say that. But if I bracket the moral issue and just put on this kind of cold-blooded realist hat, then the answer to that question, unfortunately, is yes. You know, that's what all countries do in all wars. I understand the reason for not doing it, but that said, it's what all countries do in all wars. And if you want to win, then you need to do that, for better or for worse.
Politics, maybe that's a good way to close it out, because you know so much about, you have a very unique perspective because you know a lot about Ukrainian history, but you're also, deeply up to speed with America. Most Ukrainians I know won't say it out loud because they want to keep bipartisan support. But most Ukrainians I know are afraid of the prospect of Donald Trump. It didn't go well in the first term, and they're afraid that Ukraine may cut them. He may cut Ukraine loose. I know other people have sketched a version that Ukraine could actually benefit because Donald Trump will be a hawk. And I believe you recently said that Donald Trump, you had a scenario where Donald Trump could be, take it as an ego thing that he has to defeat Putin, not for any love of Ukraine, but just because of Donald Trump's ego. How likely is that, or should Ukraine have a clear favorite in this race, presidential race?
Well, look, I mean, officially Ukraine needs to adopt a position of neutrality. It doesn't get involved in the internal affairs of countries, especially of its allies. This is a choice that the American people must make, blah, blah, blah. And of course, at the same time, you know, that means having close relations with the current administration, with Kamala Harris, Waltz. Why not have at least some kind of conversations with the other side as well? That's perfectly legitimate. Doesn't have to be the ambassador to Ukraine, to the United States. It could be you. You know, it could be anybody, right? I mean, it could be the ping pong team, as was the case with communist China. Now, having said all of that, what we can say with certainty about Harris and Waltz, well, with near certainty, is that they are likely at least to do what the Biden administration has done, possibly do more, but at least that. So these odds are very, very strong that at the very least, this will continue. It may not be adequate. It may not be desirable. It may fall short of hopes and expectations, but it's at least a floor, a minimum, which is better than nothing. The problem with the Trump Waltz and Vance position is one can concoct any number of scenarios, and I'll return to the one that you just mentioned, but it's not at all clear what the chances of their realization are. It's possible that Trump, being Trump, will in fact promote a very hard line vis-a-vis Putin. It's not inconceivable that he will decide to increase by far the number of weapons and ammunition and the amount of ammunition to Ukraine. Again, being unpredictable, being contradictory, occasionally contradicting himself in the same sentence, it's perfectly possible that he'll do that. It's perfectly possible, as I suggested in one of my recent columns, and this is an argument that you were referring to as well, is that, you know, on the one hand, we know absolutely nothing. We don't really know anything about what Trump wants. But we do know one thing, is that he believes himself to be God-given genius. There has been no other genius like him in American history, arguably in world history. And on the other side of the ocean, there's another individual by the name of Vladimir Putin, who also happens to think of himself as a God-given genius, or maybe a satanically generated genius. But in any case, he too is Russia's salvation, the best thing that could have happened to the world and everything else. So the interesting thing is, how will this potential clash between two self-styled geniuses play itself out? I don't see how they can just, you know, sit back, have a beer, slap each other on the back and say, all right, what the hell, let's just resolve this in a way that benefits Russia. I just don't see how Trump could possibly agree to his counterpoint, his counter genius, winning the day. Right. Now, that said, I don't know, right? This is just pure speculation.
Well, you're right, because there's, I call it three lanes. There's the isolationist let's drop Ukraine. That's one lane. There's what I call Biden middle of the road. Not enough, but adequate, I suppose. Well, not enough. And then the hawkish. And there are elements of the Republican Party there. I just don't see any sign that Trump's going to go there. But you're right. It could happen. And as far as Putin, remember when they surrendered Kyiv and ran out of Kharkiv, they described it as a goodwill gesture. So I think he can repackage. I don't know how well it'll work with the population, but he can repackage defeat as a victory because he controls public opinion.
Well, he could do that. Putin can do that with the population. I agree with you. Although, remember, 2 years ago, it was easier to do so because everybody was still aflush with enthusiasm. Now, after close to 600,000 dead and wounded, one has to assume that some Russians have seen the light and aren't as willing to be bamboozled. But the point for Putin, the problem for Putin, isn't so much the population. I think we make a mistake in saying, you know, we've got to focus on the population. Will they rebel? Will they not rebel? Ultimately, they don't really matter. And in most revolutionary situations, the population doesn't matter immediately. Again, I don't want to poo-poo that all completely because we have been witnesses to orange revolutions, Maidans, and all sorts of instances of people power. But that said, it's ultimately the elites. And if Putin wants to package let's say a defeat or a seeming defeat as a victory, he might be able to convince Ivan Ivanovich in Irkutsk. I'm not sure he'll be able to convince the people in the FSB, the army, the GRU, and the oligarchs who have been supporting him and who know what's going on, who know very well what's going on, and who know very well that Putin has transformed the second most powerful army in the world into, as Ukrainians joke, the second most powerful army in Ukraine. This is a scandal, and it's obvious to anybody. You don't have to be a Russia critic to understand that the performance of the army and that the loss of 600,000 men is a defeat. One doesn't have to be an economist to understand that Russia's economic relationship with China isn't that of a equal partner. It's that of a colony or at best a vassal. And Russians know this. So the question is, how long will these elites be persuaded that Putin can still save their country from defeat, possibly engineer some kind of victory? And my guess, and again, it's not just mine. I'm essentially repeating the views of many analysts in Russia as well as in Ukraine. But in any case, my guess is that sooner rather than later, that proverbial cup will run over. And again, this isn't just theory, because we have the Prigozhin affair. And whatever that means, it was obviously indicative of dissatisfaction on the part of one segment of the Russian elite, so much so that he was willing to march towards Moscow. That was impressive, albeit ultimately ineffective, but nevertheless impressive.
Well, let's hope that you will have an addendum to your imperialism ends, Chep, how imperialistic societies end. Let me close about your evolution of views about political leaders. Obviously, you're very right about Yanukovych. You had a more favorable view of Petro Poroshenko than I did and the majority of Ukrainian people did. You were very hard on Zelensky before the big war.
Oh, yes.
Justifiably so, as I learned. And just wondering if that has evolved. But what I'm... And I preface that by saying Ukrainians know victory is the only thing that they are really worried about. They're willing to put a lid on the politics, but there's a lot of pressure building up. And I'll go out on a limb and say the minute the war is over on favorable terms for Ukraine, I think he's finished because they're just tired of him. But they're going to give him the chance to finish out the war. That was my view. I don't know whether your views have evolved.
I agree with you. I mean, I was extremely harsh on him during the campaign. I even wrote an op-ed, I forget for where the headline was, Zelensky would be a catastrophe for Ukraine. Maybe it was disaster, but it was one of those two words.
It was one of those. Yes.
And, you know, the argument was the standard one. I mean, how the hell can you possibly be, how the hell would you possibly want a comedian in charge of your country? And there was a lot to be said for that. For the first 2 years, you know, yes, they hit the ground running. They passed some reforms, which were not insignificant. And then they eventually got bogged down, which was probably foreseeable, given the fact that the Friends of the People were this artificial conglomeration of random individuals. And Zelensky was, after all, in the final analysis, a comedian who was suddenly placed in the position of president. So when the war broke out, and again, I agree with you completely. I mean, Ukrainian attitudes were changing towards him, as were mine. Again, I was no longer quite as downbeat on him as I was during the electoral campaign, because he did manage to hold the country together, pass a few reforms. But I was very sympathetic with the people who were criticizing him. And then then the war breaks out. And this individual turns into a leader. I think it was my very first op-ed that I wrote in the immediate aftermath of February 24th, when Zelensky stood his ground, refused to leave, and basically told the Russians, screw you. I wrote an op-ed that appeared in the LA Times suggesting that he's the Ukrainian George Washington. Or maybe
that's
not even
a transformation.
Very much so, right? From you know, the Woody Allen of Ukraine to the George Washington of Ukraine. That's quite an impressive change. And he's fulfilled that role. You know, he hasn't been perfect, but in terms of rallying the troops, maintaining morale, presenting the country abroad, twisting arms, charming people, usually successfully, sometimes less so.
And learning English.
Learning English, exactly. Right. All of that is extremely impressive. At the same time, again, insufficient reforms, crony politics, all of that has obviously continued. And I agree with you completely that as soon as the war ends and an election is held, he's very, 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 very likely to lose. Of course, it will depend on who the alternative is. But that said, he's very likely to lose. That said, his place in Ukrainian history will be, I think, very positively remembered. We know people will forget the fact that he may or may not have managed the economy and the polity as well as he should have or could have. But they will remember that this Woody Allen turned into a George Washington for a period of 2, 3, or 4 years and essentially was able to save the country. Again, I would hardly want to suggest that he did this single-handedly. Obviously not. But his role is not insignificant. And one can only imagine, I mean, imagine what would have happened to Ukraine had he gotten on the first plane out of Kiev. It's not clear to me that Kiev would have been defended. It's not clear to me that the forces could have been rallied in the manner that they had been rallied. Because that would have been a clear signal to everybody that the ship is sunk.
Oh, man, that would have been horrible. But I want to believe that Ukraine it would defend itself, and it doesn't depend on him. I don't think it does anymore. Maybe it did. I wanted to ask you, and I'm skipping around a bit, but was there a time where Putin could have been stopped? Would it have been Chechnya, Georgia, Syria, Ukraine, or it was just the politics, the geopolitics was just
Stopped by, I mean, the Russians.
Deterred, I guess.
I mean, again, there are several answers to this question. One is I think Putin could have been stopped had NATO expanded in the early 2000s, so a few years after he comes, had it expanded to include Ukraine and Belarus, that would have been perfect, as well as Moldova, of course. At that point, that was perfectly possible, despite the fact that most of the populations were in support of that said, you know, leaders can still sign documents, it didn't matter. But had that happened, they would have been within NATO. Russia was far too weak to do anything about it. It would have squealed, it would have kicked and screamed, but they would have been within NATO, and a clear statement would have been made by the West to Putin that we will take care of these countries. Now, whether that would in fact have happened 20 years later is another story. But that said, the chances of a massive war would have been reduced significantly. Instead, by expanding as far as it did, but by not including Belarus, Ukraine, and Moldova, NATO cast them into an unsustainable no man's land, sort of the security vacuum, where on the one hand, you've got an indifferent Europe that says, yeah, we're, you know, we love you, but stay away. And on the other hand, we've got a very interested Russia that says, we love you, and yes, please come and join. And that's just unsustainable. And hence that, that multi-vector policy that Ukraine pursued, that was really the only rational response. I mean, if you're stuck in the middle, you need to have good relations with both sides. Belarus tried to do the same thing. Over time, it then basically sided with Russia while Ukraine sided with the West. But all of that could have been stopped had NATO been expanded as further, or alternatively not expanded at all, in which case there would have been, the countries in the middle would have been forced to create some kind of mutual alliance. But NATO did the worst possible thing. That's point one. I think at any step of the, over the last 25 years, the problem with the West has been, again, it's been less about any particular policy at any particular point in time. It's been about its overall attitudes toward Russia / Putin. The Germans typified this, but so did the Obama administration, Clinton, and many others as well. Namely, we were obsessed with this notion of having won the Cold War. History had ended. Liberalism would triumph. There was no alternative but to become liberal, democratic, and a good guy. And yes, Russia wasn't evolving quite the way that we might have hoped it would. And yes, Putin was a pain in the neck. That said, ultimately, that didn't matter because Mother Russia could be counted on to be reasonable and non-imperialistic and everything else. So the overall attitude on the part of world leaders, European and American leaders, business people in particular, was that there is no problem here at all. We can continue to build pipelines. We can continue to have close economic, political, and other relations, and everything will work itself out. Because it had to, because it was the end of history, because it was the end of the Cold War and we had won. And I think it was that overall attitude, you know, call it a kind of hegemonic worldview, that was the primary obstacle to seeing Russia for what it was, a very, very dangerous imperialist power headed by a man who was committed to a fascist vision of Russia. And that was simply, I mean, to even have suggested in public that that was a possibility was to go against, the rules of polite society. One couldn't even suggest that, whereas in fact that was the case. So it took a war. Even 2014, even Maidan didn't persuade too many people that Russia was a beast and that Putin was a monster. And you still had people thinking about the Minsk procedures, the Minsk Accords, and the negotiations. And if we just give it a little bit of a college try, all will be well. It took a war, and it took a genocidal war and an invasion, a full-scale invasion, to wake people up to the fact that this country, Russia, and its leader, Putin, are monsters.
Are they fully awakened?
And there again, the answer is no, they're not. I'd say the majority are. That might be 51%, but even so, I do think the majority are. And compared to where we were 3 years ago, there's been a sea change. But that said, you look at some people in the so-called realist camp of international relations, people like John Mearsheimer and others, who still believe, despite tons of evidence to the contrary, that the war is the result of the West's, of NATO's imminent desire and intent to incorporate Ukraine. Well, anybody who knows anything about NATO or anybody who knows anything about Ukraine would have known that 3 years ago, Ukraine's chances of becoming a member of NATO were exactly minus 100,
exactly.
Not even zero.
Exactly. I mean, they wrote a 10-year strategy which said, in the next 10 years, we will have closer relations. There was not even, I agree, it was not on the table. So you got some more writing to do because there are a lot more people to convince. I wanted to ask you the damage. I mean, in my mind, Holodomor, I don't know if there was a greater trauma for Ukrainians, 4 million starved to death. It was a political Ukrainians were starved into submission, basically, by Stalin. Today, we have a lot of traumas, and we don't know what the end is. How much of a setback is this? And I'm talking 6 million Ukrainians abroad. They're alive, but many are not coming back until the end of the war. We're talking the lowest birth rate in decades. We're talking a reduced territory. On the other side, they've come alive because it does seem that the will to have an independent Ukraine is not going to die. Where do you see in terms of the setbacks?
Well, the demography is obviously a clear-cut setback. I mean, I can't imagine any positive spin for that as much as I would like to. But, 6 million people have left, possibly more of that number, as you suggested. Some will return, some will not. We don't know what the number is. It obviously depends on how long the war will take, where they happen to be living at the moment. The fact that men haven't not been able to leave while women and children have may argue for the fact that many of these women and children will ultimately return, assuming their menfolk, of course, are still alive. But that, again, that might be grasping at straws. We just don't know. Also, it's somewhat heartening to know that something like a couple of million are right next door in Poland and probably, a few hundred thousand in Romania, Bulgaria, and other places. Those who've emigrated or have sought refuge in the United States and Canada simply by virtue of distance are probably less likely to return. Those who are closer are more likely to return. And of course, as we know, there have been all these incidents, especially in Germany, violence against Ukrainians. So, again, I have no idea how the local Ukrainian communities have responded to this, but I can't imagine that they're seeing this with any degree of glee. Quite the opposite. It seems to be a sign that sooner or later we're probably better off going home. That said, there is going to be a problem demographically that will have an impact, obviously, on the social structure, the demographic structure. It will have an impact on questions of national identity. On the one hand, the war has certainly generated stronger feelings of identity. Wars do that, right? You're forced to choose. You can't just sit on the fence and say, well, whatever. You're either with us or against us. And the vast majority of Ukraine's inhabitants have joined the Ukrainian side, and that's obviously encouraging. At the same time, it's the patriots, first and foremost, who are being killed.
I agree completely. I mean, Ukraine would have straightened out its problems if Russia would have just let it alone. It never seems to want to do that. Ukraine deserves support for a lot of reasons. Even if only one of them, it's that they surrendered their nuclear weapons for the Budapest Memorandum, which so far has proved worthless. But I agree with you. You've taken up a lot of your time. Do you think there's room for more black swan events? I had read some military analysts talking about this is not the last incursion or the last surprise. So what do you think?
Well, you know, as someone who experienced the collapse of the Soviet Union, albeit from afar, something that was barely imaginable in the 1980s. And then as someone who experienced this war, and I did not foresee it, by the way, I'm a firm believer in black swans. I also think that they're far more likely usual events than is often assumed. And my proof for that, by the way, is one of these village reconstructions west of Kyiv. It's about 10 miles, maybe 20 miles, you know, where they have typical houses from all of Kyiv's, from all of Ukraine's oblasts. I was there back about 5, 6, 7 years ago, and I encountered two black swans swimming lazily in one of the ponds. And that persuaded me the black swans are an everyday phenomenon, or at least have the potential to be everyday phenomena. Anyway, I'm joking, but the bottom line is, just as this particular special military operation, I think, struck everyone as a surprise, certainly the ease with which Ukraine has been able to move and advance has struck everybody as a surprise. I think all of that just goes to show, along with the fact that Ukraine was able to recapture Kharkiv pretty much without firing a shot, ditto for Kherson, the initiation of the war by Putin in February of 2022, all of these things are effectively black swans. So the notion that, you know, these things are rare and they only take place once every couple of hundred or so years is fundamentally false. So just as we've been witness to a whole series of surprising events that have been of some earth-shattering or close to earth-shattering importance, so too I'm personally persuaded that this is far from the very last incursion, far from the last surprise that we'll encounter in this particular war. My personal guess is that one of the next black swans will be Putin's departure, either thanks to nature's intervention or thanks to the intervention of some of his comrades who decided he's just got to go. I'm betting on that particular black swan.
I hope that happens, and I hope you are right, and because Ukraine deserves a lot better. And until then, I think we're going to have to strap in for what's going to be a rough ride. But I think the world's a better place that it has Alex Moidel, the professor, writing as constantly as he does, as insightfully as he does. And I really wish you great health ahead, even though you're in Putin's cohort age. I hope that you have 30 more years of writing ahead of you, Alex.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you for all your time. You have a great day, and looking forward to talking to you again.
We'll talk soon. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Ukraine Calling.